Hi, welcome to a new episode of Fein Ostwärts. Before we get started, just two quick notes. The first is about audio quality. We recorded this episode in a cafe in Hong Kong, so there is slightly more background noise than you might be used to. We listened in and decided that it was still fine as an episode, and we'd rather get it out to you guys instead of just not publishing at all, which would have been the alternative. We hope you can still enjoy the episode despite some background noise, which unfortunately wasn't avoidable. Secondly, in this episode, we are talking about the state of the protests in Hong Kong. However, we recorded the episode before the outbreak of the new coronavirus. So that is something that we are not discussing in this episode because it happened after the recording. But we still think that this episode is going to be interesting and it's going to give you very interesting and helpful background for where the protests are at right now. So yeah, hope you enjoy.
Welcome everyone to a new episode of Fein Ostwärts, this time coming to you from Causeway Bay in Hong Kong. And with me I have Mary Hui. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for making time. You're a reporter at Quartz in Hong Kong, and you've been reporting on the protests ever since they started. For anyone who hasn't read any of Mary's writing, I would highly recommend checking it out because she has brought out some amazing, really interesting pieces on various aspects of the protest movement. One thing we wanted to do is get kind of a sense of where things have gone over the past few months, and since you have been reporting on the ground since June, I'd be really interested in where you think things have gone since like August. Like things really ramped up last fall. And looking back on it, like now with maybe like a bit of hindsight, what do you feel like was the trajectory of the protests over the past few months?
Yes, so much has happened. I would say the first 3 months, June, July, August, we had a lot of mass protests, lots of fast-moving protests, hence the characterization of the protests as B-water. Protesters had really taken on this new philosophy of moving quickly and unpredictably through the city and spreading the movement beyond just the central business district in downtown Hong Kong, but also out to the neighborhoods. And that carried on into the fall. After the August airport occupation, we then had some large demonstrations in September also to mark the 50th anniversary of the Umbrella Movement, which was the 79-day occupation of major districts in Hong Kong back in 2014 to demand free and fully democratic elections for the chief executive of Hong Kong. And then another kind of big date that people had kind of looked to as a potential turning point was October 1st, 2019, which marked the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And that day, we had the first protester shot with a live round, right? So that is now, that's a kind of a seminal point in the protest movement in everyone's collective memory. And then in November, we had some large occupations and protests and clashes at universities around Hong Kong, which looked very different from the previous protests on weekends. These became full-on kind of sieges of these campuses, turning these places of learning into essentially kind of battlefields where you had students and protesters who weren't students at these campuses, and they're just holding up on the campuses, holding down the fort, and putting up these days long and very, very tense standoffs with the police. And then since then, I think things have, in terms of protests on the streets, quieted down a little bit. I think people realized that this is going to be a long haul movement. For campus sieges, I think strategically also took a lot out of many protesters. Mass arrests, of course, have also, taken the toll in one way or another, whether that's just maybe breaking up some of the frontline protester groups or just making people a little bit more worried about what it means to be out on the streets. Many of the protests have also not gotten authorization from the police, which technically then makes them illegal assemblies or unlawful assemblies. So people who may otherwise have been coming out onto for protests, people, you know, people with if young families with kids or elderly members of society, they may be less willing to come out onto the streets and take that risk. So all that has happened. But the bottom line is that even if we see numbers on the streets decreasing in protests, that is in no way, I don't think, a reflection of weakening strength of the movement. There is just so much that has been unaddressed, and each day that passes, I think we have additional protesters see additional reason to be angry and frustrated with the government and the police, and to find kind of additional injustices that they think need to be addressed.
So one thing that we'll link this in show notes, but I think at this point we're at over 7,000 arrests. Is that accurate?
I think so, yeah. Right around, yeah, 6,907, over 7,000, I believe, yeah.
It's possible, we will see, possibly today might get us to the 7,000, but something around that, so the numbers have been quite significant. I guess one thing that's also worth reminding people is that the extradition bill, which originally caused the movement to start, has been withdrawn, so that's one of the demands that has been fulfilled. Have the demands and like people's concerns changed, especially kind of like looking back to August, and now that the bill is withdrawn, what are people's main concerns when they do go out on the street?
Mm-hmm. I think the most immediate demand now is the establishment of an independent commission of inquiry into the police. There are widespread allegations of police misconduct, police brutality, excessive use of force, and blatant disregard of rules and guidelines of the police that are supposed to govern how they carry out their policing duties. And this demand for an independent commission of inquiry staffed by people outside of the police, that's not something that the government or the police have addressed or made any efforts, I don't think, at of addressing. So that continues to be a key concern for many, many protesters, because they see the police continue to police in a way that seems contrary to how a civilian police force should be conducting themselves. And at the same time, there doesn't seem to be very much, if any, accountability.
Can you give some examples of like instances of police misconduct? Because I think often people might say, oh, well, if people... There's a lot of images of protesters going around being violent, and so often people say, well, if protesters are violent, it is legitimate for police to crack down on them. But that's not really the type of misconduct that we're talking about here, right? Like, what type of police behavior is that riles people up?
Yeah, there's going to be a long list.
Maybe just like two or three examples.
Yeah, for sure. I think... You see a lot of these videos of this on live streams and just on Twitter, Facebook, social media in general. For example, police holding down and detaining a protester who is showing no signs of resistance, and yet they're going at the protester with their batons or deploying pepper spray at tear gas, a pepper spray and tear gas at close range. And I guess earlier on in the summer, we had instances of tear gas being fired in an enclosed space, which is in contradiction of all the guidelines that are supposed to govern tear gas use.
You also mentioned that it has gotten harder to basically get permission to protest. Does that look like, has the government basically been cracking down on legitimate, like what used to be legitimate ways of participating in political life? Is that like a fair characterization?
Yes. We have seen more and more applications for large marches essentially shut down by the police. And then from time to time, there are protests that are given authorization. And then maybe 2 or 3 hours into the protest, where you have hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets, the police then say suddenly, well, we're withdrawing authorization for this protest, and people have 30 minutes, 40 minutes to vacate. Otherwise, you will be at risk of arrest because of unlawful assembly. So there doesn't seem to be very much reason, or people don't see really what the police... or how the police are deciding what protests can go on and what protests can't. And it all seems very arbitrary. And so I think that in itself, means that freedom of assembly takes a hit.
Have protesters' strategies changed in response to this? I guess you mentioned that there's fewer people going out for street protests, but have people shifted to using other kinds of tactics in response to this?
I think there's a recognition now that resistance amongst the protesters doesn't only take place during mass protests. It's not just about building barricades or going out in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands to march. It's about weaving this political consciousness, this various ways of resistance into your daily life. So what does this look like? It could be choosing to go to restaurants that are openly supportive of protesters' demands. It could be setting up Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year fairs and markets, and selling kind of protest themed gifts and wares, just kind of normalizing these acts of protest and weaving it into your daily life.
Is your impression that people, because the movement has been going on for a very long time, and the government has, ever since the withdrawal of the extradition bill, been largely reticent to do anything that could be seen as giving in to any of the other demands, right? So I guess as a reminder, the four remaining demands are the investigation to police violence, amnesty for all arrested protesters, the withdrawal of the riot label for, I think, a protest in June?
Yes, exactly.
And the last one?
23.
Democracy.
Yes.
Restarting.
Yeah, exactly. The political reform so that we eventually get... universal suffrage in the election of the chief executive.
Yeah. And so government hasn't really been doing anything that looks like they even take these demands seriously, despite the numbers of people who are still going out. And also public opinion polling indicates quite broad support for the demands in general. So do you think people that protest, for example, like there was a protest in Hong Kong today, do people think that they will actually be able to get their demands fulfilled?
Yeah, I think probably the most immediate demand, the lowest hanging fruit, if I can describe it that way, would be the independent commission of inquiry into the police, and I think that would satisfy or at least address some of the most immediate sources of anger amongst protesters. And that looks like it's not impossible. Various officials, I think, including Carrie Lam, has said that that could be a possibility, but we will have to wait first for the report from the internal police watchdog. That release of the report has now been delayed because of an ongoing judicial review looking into police guidelines, which is ironic in itself. So I guess there is yet another delay, and it remains to be seen whether this report will do anything to address protest anger, and then after that, whether any official will see any official movement towards setting up an independent inquiry.
With regards to the other demands, I guess democracy or universal suffrage is the most far-reaching. Is that something that is realistically in the cards?
Not immediately, I don't think. And I really don't know what things will look like in the next 5-10 years. But I think it is realistic to say that there can be progress made towards that last demand. But as to how exactly that will look like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, that's very fair. One thing I also really wanted to ask you, because you're also from Hong Kong, you grew up here. How has the city changed ever since you started covering the protests and ever since the social this movement has been going on in Hong Kong?
I think even the regular act of walking around the city has changed completely. You walk down the street and there are many, many signs of the protest movement. You can call them scars on the urban landscape. But I don't think that word itself doesn't fully capture what we're actually really seeing just walking around the city. You certainly see a lot of damage because some protesters have been actively vandalizing traffic lights, for example, or Chinese-owned businesses or businesses associated with a pro-China stance. The metro system, the MTR, has also been damaged because of its reputation for being very much aligned with the government and the police. So you have all those traces of damage. But at the same time, you see all these messages, right, left by protesters, whether that's graffiti on sidewalks, on crosswalks, on walls. And often there's this kind of process of spraying a protest slogan onto a wall and then seeing it the next day covered up, and then the day after that seeing another protest slogan. So it's this constant kind of erasing and then writing and erasing and writing. I think kind of symbolizes kind of the start and stop rhythm of the protest movement, that it's not going to be a smooth ride all the way through. And so, just walking around the city and seeing all of that really does capture and give you a flavor of how the protests have really seeped into every single nook and cranny of Hong Kong life.
Has it changed how you relate to the city? And so when you walk, like, so you say you see these scars, but has it changed how you, for example, feel about particular places?
It makes me much more hyper aware of where I am. First of all, I think just knowing that some of the graffiti will disappear the next day makes me just stop and want to take a photo of it, or at least just to recognize it for what it is. I think just having walked through the city streets so many times along protest routes over the past bunch of months, especially over last summer, you then kind of remember certain things at a particular street or a particular crosswalk or a particular bridge where something memorable happened, where you saw police firing tear gas, or where journalists were pushed off a particular area and were cordoned off by riot police. And so just having that script play through my mind as I walk through the city streets is, I guess, in itself a way of reliving a certain history. I think every single person in Hong Kong has a different kind of history that's replaying in their mind as they're walking through the city every single day.
Yeah, I also guess I spoke to people who were here basically as tourists, and they were talking about how they don't really notice anything about the protests when they walk through Hong Kong at this point, because often when there is nothing going on at a particular time, things seem relatively normal, and unless you have that movie playing in your head, maybe it's harder to see the new meanings that places have taken on for Hong Kongers.
Yeah, for sure. I was talking to a family friend visiting this week from Australia, and they were also saying that everything looks fairly normal, you know, other than graffiti here and there. It really doesn't look like there's very much going on. But if you're looking at everything through the lens of the past 6-7 months of protests, then there's no way of escaping any of these signs.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wanted to quickly touch on, because you mentioned the matter of like vandalism and violence earlier, and like you mentioned, one thing that's been quite interesting is that a lot of the vandalism has been very targeted. And there are, at some point, there were people even posting up pieces of paper that were explaining, this is why we vandalized this particular establishment. And you said that a lot of it is targeting stores that are affiliated with the Chinese government somehow or openly pro-government. How has that impacted how the rest of Hong Kong, or I guess peaceful protesters and people who are silently supportive but might not go out in the street, relate to the protest movement? Has it limited support, and has it made people more reluctant to associate with the protesters?
Looking at polling numbers, it really doesn't seem like these more kind of uncivil acts of disobedience, including vandalism and violence, it doesn't seem like that has taken away support from the protests. Things, I think, are just so polarized and so entrenched that when protesters do vandalize property or do sometimes attack other people who may not have the same political beliefs as they do, that then just makes the anti-protest or people who are against the protests much more entrenched in their beliefs, and it reinforces, I think, the solidarity within the movement. And so each time I think one of those incidents happen, vandalism or violence from protesters, it solidifies the two camps a little bit more and widens the gap. And the longer we allow this to drag on, the wider that chasm will be.
I guess one sign of that was the district elections in November, right? When you had, while there was a sweeping victory for pro-democracy candidates, if you looked at the numbers, I think it was like something like 55-45%, so it was almost right down the middle of the people who had voted, and quite polarized in both camps. One other thing that I was interested in, because you mentioned earlier remembering scenes where police interacted with the press, which is something that has also almost become a topic in itself. So I'm curious whether in your personal experience or also in experience of your colleagues, the relationship between the press and the government and the police has changed, especially because press have been targeted by police directly in several instances.
Mm-hmm. I think in many instances, being on the front lines, a lot of members of the press have had to deal with fairly aggressive conduct from police, both riot police and their media liaison officers. The police have also put out quite a few statements saying that there is a lot of fake news going around, or that the media in this broad brushstroke has only reported on police misconduct and ignored instances of protester violence or protester vandalism. So there is a lot of antagonism, and you can feel this quite clearly just looking at the police press conferences or the statements that they put out. And so that's certainly changed, I think, the relationship between especially local members of the press and the Hong Kong police.
When you say local members, is that as opposed to foreign correspondents? Or
I think just because there were many more foreign correspondents here in Hong Kong during the summer months. And since then, I think the relationship between the police and the press has deteriorated, often it is the local members of the press who are kind of getting the brunt of it, just because by virtue of being here more consistently.
One thing that I'm curious about is that people, when they follow Hong Kong in the news, often don't get the extensive coverage that a lot of local media are doing. So there's some excellent reporting on the ground here that is like basically day by day, every event is being covered. But especially if you're following the protests from abroad, you might not hear a lot about that. And I think especially if you just follow kind of like the big events, people might get the feeling that the movement has kind of stopped because people stopped coming out on the streets. There haven't been like major clashes with police recently. And in 2014, this is kind of what the government built on as well, right? Their entire strategy seemed to be based around waiting for protesters to lose energy and for everything to just taper out. Do you think that's something that is viable as a strategy for the government again? Like, is it possible that people are just tired now and might just gradually stop coming out to protest?
I don't think that will be as much of a possibility this time around, just because there's been such a large buildup of frustrations that protesters are rallying around and a few that the government has to address. And the longer the government kind of drags this on, the longer the list of grievances that protesters have will be. And that just kind of adds to the resilience and solidarity of the movement, I think.
That makes sense, yeah. I wanted to now kind of also go into like a few specific aspects of the movement that in some cases you've reported on, in some cases that you already mentioned earlier. Because one thing you mentioned, which is quite current, are the Lunar New Year fairs. Can you maybe explain what's up with that and why they matter?
Sure. So it's kind of part of the tradition here in Hong Kong that every Lunar New Year there are these big fairs, markets, held mostly at kind of large neighborhood parks. And so you have, just imagine, I guess, multiple kind of football pitches completely taken over by these tents that are then divided into stores selling things like food and kind of fairground snacks, but also cute artsy products and various other random things that you might find in the department store, for example. This year, the government has said that the fairs shouldn't have any goods that have political messaging in them. And so people have decided to set up their own fairs outside of these government-sanctioned official fairs. And so you've seen these smaller pop-up fairs come sprouting up in various neighborhoods.
How of those have you been to any?
I've been to two, just stopped by two yesterday night. And it's a mix of everything. Some sell protest-themed products. I saw kind of chrysanthemums that were kind of decorated like little pigs, because that's a kind of a cute symbol associated with LIHKG, which is an online forum that protesters use. What else was there? There were just various things kind of branded with protest slogans. You had calendars with kind of iconic scenes from the protests, stationery, watches, and the like. And then you also had just regular snacks that had nothing to do with the protests.
How do those compare to the regular fairs?
I think it's a fairly kind of lighthearted affair. People are in the holiday mood and the spirit, so it's the two fairs, the official ones and these pop-up ones, feel the same in the sense that people are kind of just happily walking around and chuckling at funny things and testing out food and just generally having a good time. And what's different about them, I guess, is that these pop-up ones are kind of explicitly an act of protest, even if it doesn't feel like a protest. It's not within the confines of the protest that we would typically define a protest to be, being marching in the streets. This time around, it's just doing something a little different and going shopping, but with a different mindset, I suppose.
Yeah, interesting. There's also, maybe this is one thing that's worth discussing, is that you mentioned earlier the boycott of particular shops. And there's this term yellow economic circle that keeps going around, especially recently. So the boycotts are something that's been going on for a while, but can you explain what this yellow economic circle is about?
Yeah, so yellow being the color associated with the protests, I think it traces its roots back to 2014 during the umbrella movement when the yellow umbrella became a key symbol of the protesters. And so the yellow economic circle is a kind of an effort to try and for protesters to try and spend their money and bring their businesses to companies, restaurants, and whatnot that support the protest movement. And I guess the philosophy is to try and to vote with your dollars, essentially, and to support the movement with your dollars, and to not, bring business to what they may see as a blue or anti-protester, pro-China establishment.
Do you have any sense of how much impact these things actually have? Like, is this something that has substantially impacted Pilt's business, or is it just something that's more symbolic for people to, I guess, maybe feel good about themselves?
Yeah, I think in terms of the concrete economic impact, it's probably too early to tell, but I'd love to see research on that. Whether that would be... Yeah, I don't really know what the economic research question there would be concretely, but I think there are also companies that have sprouted out who have said explicitly that they are happy to hire protesters who've been arrested and charged for various protest-related offences, who may have trouble getting a job at other companies. So I think that also is supposed to help add to the resilience of the movement, I suppose, to make it another form of decentralized support for the movement and the protesters in it.
Are there any other ways in which people have been trying to build more long-term structures that could support people organizationally or economically in the long run? Maybe it seems that people are increasingly realizing how much of a long fight this is going to be. Maybe in August, you might still be able to tell yourself this will be short and we just need to win this one battle, and then we might convince the government to give in. But now it seems that people are mentally looking forward and realize that this will be a long-term thing. So are there other ways in which they might be preparing for that?
One of the clearest things we've seen is the number of new unions that we've seen formed over the past couple of months. I think a lot of people have realized that because this movement will go on for so much longer, and because for much of the protest movement, it's largely been leaderless and decentralized. But if the protest movement is to sustain itself over a longer period of time, there will have to be a more kind of formal support system. Even if it's not a leadership structure, there will have to be some way of protesters and workers in this instance to take more concerted action and to kind of band together. And so you have all these unions forming for various different industries, including ranging from finance to advertising to construction, as ways to prop up the movement and sustain it for longer.
Yeah. Is that something that is new for in terms of Hong Kong culture? Is Hong Kong a city that has had a strong union culture before the protests happened?
I don't think so. I don't know what the numbers are for unionization prior to this, but it's not something that I have been aware of myself. I've known for a long time that unions have been around and they have played important roles in previous social movements in Hong Kong. Of a smaller scale, but the scope of new unions forming and the number of people signing up to unions this time around is fairly unprecedented.
One other thing that also you've written and spoken about this repeatedly as well before is the role of Cantonese in the protest, and especially also the role of language as a means of protest, and also Cantonese humor is something that's been very prominent. And so I was wondering whether you could first give me a sense of why language matters so much in the context of Hong Kong.
Sure. I think first and foremost, Cantonese is a key part of Hong Kongers' identities. It is... it's irreverent. There's a lot of swearing involved. There's a lot of play on words. It's catchy. There's a mix of both English and Cantonese in a lot of Cantonese phrases, which reflects back on Hong Kong's colonial history. And so all that added together makes for a very kind of quintessentially Hong Kong experience and image and sound. And with the Hong Kong identity being such a key part of the protest movement, so much of this is about safeguarding the freedoms and the liberties that many Hong Kongers have known to be so central to Hong Kong. It means that the Hong Kong identity is very much tied up with the protest movement. And so anything that I think reflects that and reinforces that, in this case, Cantonese, ends up playing a very, very key role. And so we've seen this play out in slogans, songs, ways that insults thrown at protesters by the police or government officials have then been kind of repurposed and reappropriated and then re-weaponized as memes and retorts and phrases to rally protesters around that's just been something quite amazing to see.
Can you give some examples of like instances of where Cantonese has been central to like a meme or like a slogan or something? Like, what have been things that particularly stuck on your mind or that particularly caught your attention?
The first one that comes to mind is, this was probably back in June, when riot police, I think, yelled at a particular reporter. The reporter said, "I'm a reporter, you know, maybe like stop pushing," or something. I forget the exact context. And so the police go, the reporter goes, "Yes, I'm a reporter," and the riot police shouts back and says, in Cantonese, "Gay lay lol mol," which means, you know, like, "reporter my ass," or literally, like, "reporter your mum," or "you motherfucking reporter." So that's meant as an insult, but of course, people then kind of really latch on to this short, colourful phrase and turn it into something that we now see on keychains, on t-shirts, on posters, on like cake decorations, on cupcakes, on mooncakes. It's just people just use it and turn to it, and you just have to utter the phrase to then kind of draw up all these various commentations.
Interesting. Do you think, like you mentioned earlier, Cantonese is like an extremely irreverent language. Fun fact is I'm currently taking Cantonese classes. My Cantonese teacher actually spent an entire section just on swear words because he said it's very important for communicating in Cantonese.
I agree.
Do you think it is, can you try to describe, I think this is something that's hard to transport. Is Cantonese different from English in that regard? Like, do you feel like it is a language that people use to express themselves differently? Because a lot of people are bilingual in the city.
Mm-hmm. How is it different? I think, I'm no linguistic expert, of course, but Cantonese feels much more variable, just because of, I suppose, the kind of monosyllabic, nature of Cantonese, which is also true of, you know, Mandarin, Japanese, Korean, but you do have a lot more scope for playing on words and different ways that you would pronounce a certain thing. And the fact that this multitonal also opens up all these various different possibilities. And so in that regard, I think you then have just so much more scope of making slight changes to a certain phrase that then makes it gives it a completely different meaning.
Yeah. Do you think, my understanding is that written Cantonese is quite different from how you speak Cantonese. So would it be accurate to say that Cantonese can be quite variable because the spoken language develops almost entirely by itself and there's not really much of a written record that it's tied to, maybe with the exception of chat logs?
Right. Yeah, it's so much more colloquial when spoken. And yeah, I don't really know why that isn't reflected in the written form of Cantonese. Yeah, just the fact that it's so informal, spoken Cantonese, informal and creative, just lends itself to making it kind of quite a powerful tool for protesters.
Yeah. One other thing that you've also written about is our kind of like protest strategies, and you've written about like the role of technology and also the role of like live streaming in particular. So I'm curious whether there's any bits there that you'd be interested in highlighting that you think are especially worth paying attention to.
Yeah, I think a lot of coverage that we've seen throughout the many, many months of protests since last June is just the sheer amount of live streaming. You really do have hours and hours of coverage from a single outlet of these marches, of clashes, and whatnot. And so what you end up having is this record of some of the most memorable and iconic moments of the protest movement that would probably otherwise not have been documented had it not been for a live streamer being at the right place at the right time. And that's for better, for good and bad. It's good in that we have this excellent record of what's happened. It adds to the record of history, and it's a key part of this large trove of evidence. And then on the other side, of course, it is probably quite stressful and anxiety-inducing for people to be watching these moments over and over and over again. But at the same time, it means that researchers and investigators will have a huge amount of data and evidence to be working off of.
Do you have a sense of, you mentioned the anxiety part, do you have a sense of whether this has impacted people's general well-being after more than half a year of constant like political division and strife and also a lot of like kind of a barrage of a lot of violent imagery?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had the Lancet published a study earlier this month that showed that, I forget the exact numbers now, but I think it was estimated more than 1 in 3 Hong Kongers now have exhibited signs of PTSD and depression. That's huge. We essentially are seeing a mental health crisis unfold across the city. And this cuts, of course, across all political lines, all class lines. And unless that's addressed properly, I think we will see ramifications of this in the years to come.
Yeah, that makes sense. Does it feel like the government is taking these issues seriously? Because this is basically a public health problem, right?
Mm-hmm. It is. I think for the government to try and address this public health issue will mean that first and foremost they have to address some of the demands that the protesters have, because that's what's fueling these protests, which are in turn fueling the public health mental health crisis. So if the government is to do something, they will have to go back to the basics, which is to address the root of this entire social movement.
That makes sense. Is there anything else you would like to add, like something that you think is important to pay attention to over the next few weeks, things to look out for when people are following the protests, or just something that you think is an important aspect that I forgot to ask about?
I think this is something you've mentioned already, but I think just one thing to keep in mind, especially as people are looking, reading about Hong Kong and following the news out of Hong Kong, is that protests are no longer confined to the large marches that we've seen, and that so many kind of iconic photos have depicted the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people squeezing into out onto the streets. That may not happen with as much frequency, but the protests continue, and we have to keep an eye on that and see what forms the protest movement will take in the months to come.
Okay, great. If people want to follow you, they can follow you on Twitter, presumably. We will link you. We'll also link to you in the show notes. Is there anyone else? Obviously, people should be following Quartz and your reporting and your colleagues' reporting. Are there any other sources that you would recommend people follow if they want to keep up with what's happening?
The three kind of major English language news outlets from Hong Kong would be the Hong Kong Free Press, RTHK, and the South China Morning Post. I can't reel off their Twitter handles accurately right off the bat here, but yes, I would go to them for a lot of English language updates.
Okay, amazing. Well, thanks again so much for making time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Hallo, ich bin's nochmal, Katharin. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Ich hoffe, euch hat die Folge gefallen. Wie immer freuen wir uns über Feedback, über sämtliche Kanäle, Twitter, E-Mail, Kommentare, was auch immer euch gefällt. Wir freuen uns natürlich auch über Bewertungen bei iTunes oder wo auch immer. Darüber hinaus, wenn ihr wollt, könnt ihr unsere Arbeit unterstützen, finanziell, indem ihr, sei es durch einmalige Spenden oder sei es durch regelmäßige Spenden, ihr könnt zum Beispiel eine Mitgliedschaft bei Steady abschließen. Das haben wir bei uns in den Shownotes verlinkt, also könnt ihr in die Shownotes schauen, da kann man dann so regelmäßige Sachen machen. Ihr könnt uns auch einfach bei PayPal eine einmalige Spende schicken, das ist paypal.me/fernostwärts, auch verlinkt. Oder ihr könnt uns einfach ganz traditionell eine Überweisung schicken, falls ihr unsere Arbeit gut findet und uns finanziell dabei unterstützen wollt. Darüber hinaus ist es ja auch so, dass wir mittlerweile einen Newsletter schreiben. Das heißt, alle 2 Wochen gibt es montags eine Zusammenfassung der aktuellen Ereignisse in Taiwan, Hongkong und China von uns. Den Newsletter gibt es bei Substack und der ist auch, wie immer, in den Shownotes verlinkt. Oder ihr könnt ihn finden, indem ihr zu fanostwärts.substack.com geht. Also ein deutschsprachiger Newsletter, immer auf Deutsch, der alle 2 Wochen montags rauskommt. Genau, das war die letzte Ansage. Oh nein, und als allerletztes, da wir das jetzt mit den regelmäßigen Veröffentlichungen machen, nächste Folge gibt es wie immer am 1. Mittwoch des Monats, also am 1. Mittwoch im März. Das wird der 4. März. Das Thema steht noch nicht fest, aber wir haben 2 super spannende Folgen für euch in petto und genau, hoffen, dass ihr euch drauf freut und bis dahin alles Gute und vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.